It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The Obama administration announced today that it will end its program to train moderate rebel forces in Syria, admitting that the program didn't work. The news comes as Syrian refugees continue to flow into Europe, and Russia steps up its role in the region, launching airstrikes against ISIS. Syria stands at the center of some of the United States' biggest foreign policy challenges.
Last week, in response to those challenges, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson said that he supports sending U.S. ground troops into Syria as part of an international coalition to set up safe zones. He's here with us now to talk about why he supports that. Senator Johnson, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to, Rob.
Well, last week you said you support sending U.S. ground troops into Syria. Can you describe what that mission would look like?
Well, let me be very accurate. What I said is I supported, first of all, setting up a no-fly zone so that Assad would be prevented from barrel bombing his own citizens. You know, the slaughter's already claimed the lives of close to 250,000 Syrians. And then what I said is, you know, I think the American, America has to show leadership and assemble a coalition of the willing. And the example I used was the first Gulf War, where President George H.W. Bush assembled a really pretty impressive coalition of the willing. We did supply about two-thirds of the troops for that effort, about 500,000 American troops, but there were 250,000 troops supplied by our coalition partners, and our coalition partners paid for about 85% of that effort. So again, I don't think we need an effort that massive, but I think we need is a coalition of the willing. I think the West has got to realize that this the events in Syria are spilling out of control. We have to look at the fact that not only has Assad slaughtered 250,000 of his own people, but there are 7.6 million Syrians displaced within Syria, 4 million refugees outside of Syria, so the flow into Europe, it's just the tip of the iceberg, and we have to recognize that the events in Syria are not confined to Syria. They're spilling over. They're going to be stabling other nations. And we need to recognize the root cause of the problem really is the events in Syria. So let's stabilize Syria as opposed to having to deal with the enormous refugee flow that will only increase if we don't actually look at the root cause and solve it there in Syria.
So how would this coalition of the willing stabilize Syria? I think you had said something about ground troops from the U.S. and other countries creating safe zones.
Well, first of all, I think we have to be very overt and very vocal in terms of what our strategy is. Establish the no-fly zone, so we basically put Russia in Syria and Assad on notice that we're not going to allow you to slaughter Syrian citizens anymore. And then we very overtly, again, tell you, this is the region that we are going to establish a safety zone, a security zone for Syrians so they know they would be under the protection of a coalition of the willing. And that would be America and Western and Europe, as well as the Gulf states. So, again, I think you need to be very overt in your strategy, but you have to have a strategy, which we do not have right now.
Would that coalition include Russia if they're willing to join?
If they'd be willing to join, but here's the problem is we haven't done this, and so now Russia has basically, come in and filled that void together with Iran. And so you really are, what we're witnessing right now, I think very sadly, is a strategic realignment within the Middle East. And if you really need to understand that the reality that you've got America combined with Europe, our economies, our economic strength is over $30 trillion. Russia and Iran combined is less than $3 trillion. So they're not even a tenth of our economic power, and yet look who's pushing who around. So, I don't think it's good for the world. I don't think it's for the good for the Middle East and the region to have Russia and Iran be the ascendant powers there versus the West and the Gulf states.
Suppose we have American troops and other coalition partners creating these safe zones in Syria. How long, then, does that last until ISIS is defeated, until the Assad regime is overthrown? When would the end point be?
So we haven't even talked about ISIS and the caliphate that they've established. And caliphate requires territory. We just had a hearing with FBI Director Comey and Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson and the head of our National Center Counterterrorism Center. And we talked about the fact that ISIS, the caliphate, requires territory. But as long as they have that territory, they're going to continue to inspire the types of homegrown terrorist attacks we've seen in our soil, as well as foreign fighters flowing into that region. This is a very dangerous situation, and it's a situation that we are really not addressing effectively.
But how would you like to see the U.S. do more to target ISIS while also, it sounds like, opposing the Assad regime?
We need to come up with a strategy to accomplish the goal that President Obama stated, which is degrade and ultimately defeat ISIS, and we have to defeat them sooner rather than later. You know, one of the problems we have in Syria is that President Obama, again, the commander-in-chief, president of the world superpower, demanded that it was time for Assad to leave. I mean, that's all well and good to say that, but, you know, as the leader, the commander-in-chief of America, you better have a backup plan. You better understand, well, okay, well, that's great if you ask, for example, Gaddafi to go and then assist rebel forces of toppling Gaddafi. Well, what's your backup plan? How are you going to govern Libya? I think as Colin Powell said, if you break it, you kind of own it, and we did nothing in Libya, so now we have a failed state in Libya. ISIS is infiltrating that situation. We have, obviously, a failed state in Syria, and, of course, what Russia is doing right now. By the way, they're not coming in to bomb ISIS. They're coming in to defeat the moderate opposition to Assad. They're going to bolster the Assad regime that is, again, responsible for this this limited genocide, 250,000 Syrians slaughtered. So, again, we need to show leadership. We need to assemble that coalition of the willing, where events will continue to spin out of control and the wrong people remain in power.
But I'm hearing you say we need to step up this action against ISIS. We're already doing these airstrikes, bombing campaigns. Apart from the safe zone you're talking about, which wouldn't necessarily target ISIS, what should we be doing militarily, tactically, diplomatically, even, that we aren't doing now?
Well, again, you have to take a look at the mistakes, the blunders that brought us to this very difficult situation where our options are limited. You know, we won the Iraq War, then we lost it, you know, partly because of Iranian involvement, and then we won it again, and we had a stable situation. Let's face it, President Obama, Vice President Biden said that, Iraq was a huge success, and then we bugged out. We didn't learn the lessons of history of leaving a stabilizing force behind in Iraq as the glue that was going to hold that fragile coalition together, like we did in Germany and Japan and South Korea. Those are successful models of utilizing America's economic and military might to stabilize the situation. We didn't do that. So now the situation has deteriorated dramatically, both in Iraq and Syria. So again, we can continue to let things just spin out of control. We can allow Iran and Russia become ascendant in the Middle East. I don't think that's good. You know, and I don't think it's humane to be talking about just dealing with the refugee crisis when we're not dealing with the slaughter of Syrians in Syria. So I keep going back. We need leadership. We don't have it right now. Now, I'm not in charge of foreign policy. The President of the United States is. He's not showing the leadership. And so events continue to spin out of control, and Russia and Iran are on the ascendancy in the Middle East. That's a very bad and dangerous situation. And his policy, you know, the limited bombing strikes obviously haven't worked to degrade ISIS.
We're talking to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. He represents Wisconsin. I want to come a little closer to home, to the U.S. House. Appears to be a Republican leadership crisis among your colleagues in the House of Representatives. Kevin McCarthy abruptly dropped out of the race to be Speaker yesterday. Chaos in the House, some have said. How would you propose bringing together different factions, conservatives, more establishment or moderate Republicans among your colleagues in the House?
Well, as we were talking about international affairs there and the lack of leadership, we're in a position in America where America is hungering for leadership, and we need it. We need effective leadership. And I think that the problem that the Speaker Boehner had is a very top-down leadership model, and you really do need in the House a leader, somebody who can, you know, bridge the differences between the different factions within the House conference. I know a lot of people are talking about Paul Ryan. Paul's a person of integrity. He's a person of ideas. He's a family man, which is one of the real conflicts. So I don't think the House really needs advice from a United States senator other than to say we need a person of integrity. We need somebody who can really bring those factions together. We need a leader. Certainly, you know, my heart is with Paul. I've communicated with him. I told him my prayers are with him. He's got a tough choice.
And then I want to turn to your Senate race next year against your former opponent, Russ Feingold, a rematch of sorts. This seat is coming up on a lot of lists of likely Senate seats to flip in 2016. Might be a harder year for Republicans in Wisconsin during a presidential race, typically in the past. What is your plan? What's your strategy going in?
Well, I'm actually feeling pretty good about the race. I think what Wisconsin realized in 2010 is they're looking for somebody who actually has private sector experience. I'm a manufacturer. I'm an accountant. That's a pretty valuable perspective in Washington, D.C. You know, somebody who's had a full career, you know, from the private sector, bring that lifetime experience to Washington as opposed to a career politician. You know, somebody like Senator Feingold who believes, really, he's one of the elite of America that thinks he's so smart that he can, you know, pass a law, for example, Obamacare, to tell you what kind of health care plan you need to buy. So I've got greater confidence in the people of Wisconsin to be able to make those decisions for themselves. So it's going to be a pretty stark contrast between somebody like myself who has confidence in the people of Wisconsin to make decisions for themselves versus Senator Feingold, who thinks he's so smart that he can pass these laws, that he's dedicated to growing what I think most people realize is a pretty dysfunctional federal government. I want to limit the federal government. I want to transfer governing power back to the governed, back to the state and local level where we can actually solve problems. So it's going to be a very stark contrast. It's going to be the same decision. I think Senator Feingold's challenge is going to be to tell Wisconsin why they were wrong in 2010 when they decided that he should retire after 18 years of not doing a whole lot.
You've challenged Senator Feingold, former Senator Feingold, on campaign finance issues. We presented him with some of those critiques when he was on the show. I want to throw some critiques of your campaign. Democrats have brought up again your self-funding of your previous campaign. You had spent about $9 million and then soon after the election received $10 million in deferred compensation from your old plastics company. Even if that's within the letter of the law, doesn't it look a bit like the company, in effect, bankrolled your campaign?
Not at all. What I did when I was building my business after I bought it back from the multinational corporation that I was the general manager under, I never took a salary. I invested everything back in the business so it could grow, it could provide secure employment to the people that worked with me. And so when I won the Senate race, it was time to sever my relationship. And so we went to our accounting firm and developed a deferred compensation agreement. And so I got compensated for my 13 years of running the business. And it's passed muster with not only the FEC but also the IRS during an audit of the company. So it was a reasonable level of compensation based on the size of the company, based on the profitability of the company. It had nothing to do with, you know, what I invested in my campaign, what I invested in America, which I think was an appropriate level as well. I was concerned about this country. I'm panicked for this country. I've been there 4.5 years. We don't have enough people that have my skill set. Understanding and being willing to recognize reality and describe the reality and tell the citizens of Wisconsin the truth about these problems we face.
Also concerns about out-of-state money, outside political groups, already seeing internet ads. One said, Russ Feingold, too liberal, too Washington, too yesterday. That was from the Club for Growth. Former Senator Feingold challenged you to sign a pledge trying to keep these groups out of the election. You haven't signed yet. Are you welcoming these groups into the election?
Well, first of all, Senator Feingold loved campaign finance reform, basically incumbent protection reform when he was an incumbent. You realize the minute he became a non-incumbent, he pretty well violated the exact principles of his own campaign finance law. He actually was proposing a law in 1995 that would have not allowed the same organization he started in February 2011. As soon as he became a non-incumbent, he would have basically prevented them from doing exactly what he's doing with that. So he set up this shadow campaign, developed a list of donors, outside of Wisconsin that is now going to basically finance his campaign. So before I talk about any kind of badger pledge, I think Senator Feingold has to really answer for his hypocrisy, his phoniness, in really, turning away from exactly the type of campaign finance law that was an abject failure, but violate those same principles, those same pledges that he made to the citizens of Wisconsin. So he's got an awful lot to answer for before I would even consider his badger pledge.
Senator Johnson, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Have a great day.
That was Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson.